Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight we have Morgan Spurlock, Oscar-nominated director of Super Size Me. He's returning with a new documentary on the Comic-Con phenomenon, where it started, how it's grown over the years into this behemoth annual event. We'll be playing his interview a little bit later, and then closing off the show with our second part of our conversation with Mark W. Travis concerning film directors and all of their secretive bag of tricks in dealing with actors and screenwriters. Jerry, how are you, man?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
Good. Big movie weekend. The third biggest opening of all time with The Hunger Games.
Yeah. And good, more power to it. It's actually a pretty good movie. It's a very good movie, actually.
It's like a modern retelling of, like, the Most Dangerous Game, right?
Yeah, I mean, kind of. And I know people want to jump on the Battle Royale bandwagon, and rightfully so. But I honestly believe Susan Collins never has seen or heard of Battle Royale before she wrote this. Because if you know the story, this is really influenced by her father's involvement in the Vietnam War and her reaction to reality television, such as Survivor. And as much as I think Battle Royale is definitely one of the greatest movies ever made, this is for a young adult's story. This is a very violent movie and story for young adults. And it's actually, I think, very well done. Is it better than the book? I don't know. I'd have to go back and read the book, and I haven't read the next two in the trilogy yet. But there are people, obviously, who are going to be on the side of the book and maybe on the side of the movie. But I think it's incredibly well done. And my hat's off to Jennifer Lawrence, who just makes anything she's in as good as gold. Even inferior movies like Crazy and The Beaver, she manages to make very worthwhile.
Yeah, she's very good. You know, so Gary Ross directed this, who wasn't the first name to pop into mind when a lot of people were circling around this project. But, I mean, he's got a major franchise on his hands.
He's got, he'll probably come back to do the next two, I would think. I mean,
they're looking for this to pick up the Twilight slack once that ends this summer or whenever it is.
I mean, this may be bigger than Twilight, if that's possible. I hadn't really kept up with anything going on online recently, but when I can gather, this is all the talk of the town the last couple of months. People waiting for this. I mean, this is just amazing. I think it's good that people are this excited about a book, let alone a movie, but as someone pointed out, it's very good that people are this excited about a movie, since everyone's going on and on about how the movies are dying. Oh, we're going to have to watch them on our fucking phones and whatnot. No, I think this is good. And this is what I said about it. I'll defend the Twilight movies. I think it's great if this is what people are at least going to the movies in droves. That we need this, because this raises everyone's boat. This raises the little rinky-dink independent movie, everybody. This raises everyone's boat when a movie like this comes along, so cherish it, because otherwise it's just, oh, it's doom and gloom, there's nothing to see, the movies are dying. No, this is what you want. As Roland would agree with me 100% on this, you want this. You want this very badly.
Well, it does, yeah. I mean, any hit is good for everyone, but
right.
It's just, I think the culture of nonstop shallow hits is not good in the long run. But I'm not saying that The Hunger Games is. I don't think it is. But
I don't even know. Yeah, all right, granted, yeah. I mean, the shallow hits. But you sort of, it's like work. Work, as much as we hate work or the office or whatever, it makes you cherish the things that you fight for to get through that day. How should we say it? Worthwhile. It makes you cherish those, the things that you're working towards. That's the same thing with crappy movies. You need them to balance out the good stuff. You need to remind yourselves why those movies are good. Not everything can be There Will Be Blood.
That's
there
what
has
I'm saying.
To be Jack and Jill. There
that's what I'm
be.
Saying. As long as there is a balance.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And
I mean,
too often there isn't.
Yeah.
Is what
but
I'm
I mean,
saying.
I don't know. I think you have enough. I've seen enough good movies, surprisingly good movies this year. But, yeah, I mean, but you, it's not, I mean, like I said, you do need, like, the, I mean, basically you do need an Adam Sandler movie to balance everything out. Or, I mean, that's a shame. I hate to say that. I wouldn't have said
He's a great equalizer.
He is He is the ultimate equalizer these days. I didn't.
He should play. He should play the equalizer in the movie of the TV.
He should. I mean, what he's got this one with Andy Samberg coming out soon.
Oh, it looks awful.
Oh my God! Really? All that's missing is Dane Cook in that.
You know, they actually are making. They're either making the Equalizer or whatever the Robert Urich '80s series was, or maybe both. I don't remember. Anyway, yeah. Speaking of. Shallow. Brett Ratner is attached to another movie.
And which movie is this? I remember reading about this, but I forgot.
Midnight Run 2.
Now, is this going to be with De Niro?
Yes. I mean, De Niro has really been pushing for it for years. He's wanted to return to that well.
Right.
Charles Grodin says he's not... He's retired, but he would consider coming back for it. But I'm thinking that it's probably going to be in a much lesser capacity.
Right.
So they're writing the script, writing a final draft of the script now, hopefully, and Brett Ratner's attached to direct, which I don't know. There are lots of thoughts on Brett Ratner.
It gave us our most press.
Yeah. Well, that's you know, that's one good thing in his favor. But I think he's kind of unfairly marred. I mean, he's not terrific. He's capable. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm sure he's maybe a responsible filmmaker in terms of what the studio expects. So he's not the most inspired choice. I don't know why they don't go back to Martin Brest, or maybe they have.
Is he allowed to work anymore?
Well, he should be. I mean, he kind of originated that material, and he's mm-hmm. and you look at the snap of a Beverly Hills Cop and a Midnight Run 2. I mean, that's the kind of snap that Brett Ratner's been trying to chase his whole life.
Right.
And that's why Ratner's attached to the Beverly Hills Cop sequel Forever and a Day too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you know, you could get him, you could. I mean, obviously, David Gordon Green with Pineapple Express would be another one I think he would be up for the challenge, but
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I he is so wrapped up in comedy, but so wrapped up in Eastbound and Down and with the back-to-back The Sitters and Your Highness, it's neither one really lit the box office on fire. They might want to go with someone like Brett Ratner instead. But we'll see what happens. I would love to see Grodin come back because that was I would love to. Two of them worked off so well.
Oh yeah,
I mean, such a good movie, such a very funny movie.
A true like odd couple.
Yeah,
and it's really Grodin's finest hour. I mean, he's in film.
Right.
I'm sure he would agree with that, even though he's been a part of, you know, Rosemary's Baby and a couple other really
right,
good
right.
movies. But also, here's an exciting piece of movie news.
All right, I guess I got to hear now. I mean, with that kind of intro, I mean...
De Palma is now shooting. He started shooting the beginning of this month.
You're right, yeah, Passion.
Yeah, on his new thriller. An erotic thriller with Rachel McAdams and the first girl with the dragon tattoo. Why do
Naomi
I always...
Ortiz?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, so good stuff. I'm excited.
Do we know what the movie... Besides being an erotic thriller, do we know what it's about, or...
Yes, because it's based on a film with Kristin Scott Thomas, I think, that was released just a couple of years ago.
Oh, okay.
I'll look it up.
So wait, De Palma's doing a remake. All right, an actual, honest to God remake from De Palma.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose. I don't know how much it kind of steers away from that source material, but that's true. And also related to Brian De Palma, Kimberly Pierce, it looks like she's getting closer to making Carrie, her remake of Carrie. And Chloe Moretz is in the final running for the lead. It's between two people, and Chloe Moretz is one of them.
Wow, okay.
So the general consensus is Chloe Moretz is terrific, a terrific actress,
mm-hmm.
but too pretty for the role.
That's going to be true with a lot of actresses today. You're going to get that, I mean...
So you need someone homely.
Yeah, I mean, who's going to, you know, I don't know.
You know, I'm not sure I agree with that assessment, actually, because you can be a pretty girl and be raised in that environment, and it makes it makes you what you are, and you carry that with you, and that's what people latch onto and kind of crucify her about.
Right. That you could. You're absolutely right.
But she's pretty much a weirdo, an outcast.
Mm-hmm.
It's really one of the ultimate like outcast stories, outcast fights back kind of story.
Right.
But I'm excited. I think she's the right director for it, too.
Okay, wait, this movie is that there's a remake of? That the De Palma? Is that only from 2010, I think? Love Crime, I think,
mm-hmm.
is the movie. That's only from, like, 2 years ago. Wow,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, way to go, all right. Well, I guess. I mean, I just don't... Wow, okay, wow. That's yeah, I wanted to see that when I was... I got to rent it on DVD, but... yeah.
Well, you know, right now on Broadway, there's Death of a Salesman,
mm-hmm.
that's playing. And I'm sure 2 years from now, there'll be another production of Death of a Salesman somewhere in the country.
Yeah, but Death of a Salesman has been in circulation. Love Crime's only been, like, maybe 2 years. And I mean, great to let the original sink in. It's like this thing with this movie, The Raid, The Redemption, which I haven't seen yet, but they're already remaking that, too. And the original is supposed to be this wham-bam Indonesian action film, and they're going to remake it, and it's just like, let's just hold off a while. Let's hold off a couple of years. Let everyone see the original one first. I have no problem with a remake, but, you know, let people see the original one first. You know, give that a chance to breathe.
I understand what you're saying. But, I mean, I'm kind of less sensitive about the whole remake thing, because if you look upon it as, like, a revival, like any kind of play... plays that are new, plays that aren't new. It makes sense, and especially when you're dealing with a director with a vision. I mean, if it's just rehashing just to get it in front of an American audience, that's one thing. But De Palma is somebody that could give a new take to something.
He could. I'm surprised he's doing an out-and-out remake like this, though. That is, I didn't realize it was this film. That's...
I think he's happy to be working again. It's been a while since he's been able to make a movie.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Everything's
2007, right?
Yeah, everything's kind of fallen apart. Every time he takes a step towards a film, and the financing bottoms
mm-hmm.
out, or so he's had a really difficult time with it.
Right, right.
And this being an erotic thriller, I mean, this is perfect for him. This is perfect for his unique touch.
Right, right. Now, you know, I mean, I'd be curious. I mean, like you said, it's good to see him working again.
Yeah. Okay, let's get to our first interview, and then we'll bring on Dean. He'll talk a little bit about the Atlanta Film Festival, and then we'll talk a little bit about character actors, I think. I think that'll be our list tonight.
Okay.
And then Tuesday night is Robert Towne, or Wednesday night.
Wednesday night is Robert Towne.
Yeah, I talked to him on Tuesday. I'm nervous. I don't know. I'm nervous talking to him. Anyway, that'll air on Wednesday night. So let's get to our interview. Morgan Spurlock, the Super Size Me fame, he's got a new documentary out. It's called Comic-Con Episode 4, A Fan's Hope. And I believe it opens up in theaters next Friday.
Mm-hmm.
and it's really great. I think it's his best work since Super Size Me, and it's an exploration of this whole culture that is built up around Comic-Con and the acceptance of the geek and kind of their relevance in the entertainment world today, as seen through the filter of Comic-Con. And here is Morgan to talk about his film.
Welcome to Comic-Con!
Sit in my chair, let me make you look dead.
Fuck us off, everybody.
I'll never forget the first time I took a peek next to a stormtrooper and a Klingon. That could only happen at Comic-Con.
Okay, we're good.
All right, guys.
I was looking out my hotel room window and I saw three Ninja Turtles really impatiently checking their watches.
Where? Excuse me. You have to check that in.
In the mind of every comic book fiend, Comic-Con is just the answer to all your prayers. It's like heaven, in as much as, like they always tell you, when you go to heaven, everything you've ever lost is going to come back to you.
My wife's not too ecstatic about this whole toy collecting thing.
Let's go.
But I will not leave that con unless I have those figures.
Love Paul!
Comic-Con is a job fair for comic book industry.
Jump into the fire, as Duran Duran would say.
I read comics every day as a kid, and I really, really want to do this so badly.
Entry 11!
Comic-Con is a great place for exposure. And it's a big chance for me to get myself out there. It's about getting all your friends together and going on a suicide mission. And that's what this is. It's a suicide mission for my future.
I am Krogan!
I'm practically vibrating right now. I feel like I'm the Flash and I can just move through solid objects.
I can go back in time and tell, like, 11-year-old me, like, one day not only do you go to Comic-Con, you go to Comic-Con every year. So much so that, like, you get greeted by Stan Lee when you show up. You know, and the 11-year-old me would be like, how did we get so fat?
What are you particularly obsessively geeky about?
Wow, that's a good question. As a kid, I loved video games. Like, I loved growing up playing, like, my Atari and my ColecoVision. I obsessively, you know, collect, like, Plastic Man comics. Like, I loved Plastic Man as a kid. And G.I. Joe, when they did, like, the big G.I. Joe reboot in, like, the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
But now, what am I obsessive about now? Probably the biggest thing is the thing that I'm most obsessive about is, are, like, you know, vinyl toys in and around, like, you know, lowbrow art and, mm-hmm. like, you know, Pop's Realist Art, you know, stuff that, like, Ron English, who did the Fat Ronald for Super Size Me back in the day, turned me on to this whole world of artists, that now that is kind of like my big geek obsession passion.
Well, but when you were younger, did you feel a community with other people that had the same kind of obsessions that you did? Or?
Yeah, but I mean, back then, you know, there were people that I was friends with where we all would geek out over these types of things. But it's not like it is now. Like, back then, it wasn't nearly as cool to be a geek and to love this stuff. You know, it's like you go back, like, I'm 40, and you go back that long, and you know, you weren't seen as being the cool kid if you know, liked comic books and you liked to play video games. And, you know, it became much more of a cultural phenomenon that was acceptable, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s. I feel like comic books were still seen as like that kind of subgenre of things you didn't really get to be cool if you liked. And now you got frat guys wearing, you know, Green Lantern t-shirts.
It's seeped into the mainstream culture now.
Absolutely. Well, cause, I was having this conversation earlier today, is like, you know, there was this idea of, like, geeks were people who, you know, geeks were the guys who liked comic books and you know, these types of, you know, oddball things. Nerds were the people who loved to, like, computer program and, like, sit alone in a room. And now those two have converged, and those people now control everything. So mm-hmm. those geeks and nerds run the entertainment business. They run the computer businesses. They run every startup that's on the planet today. And so now it has kind of bled into mainstream culture. You know, where now it is cool to be that geek and that nerd.
Yeah, they truly have inherited the earth. But this started, this whole idea of a documentary started as a suggestion from Stan Lee, is that right?
As a conversation from Stan Lee. How bananas is that?
Wow.
Crazy. Yeah, so no, Stan Lee and I, like Jeremy, my producing partner Jeremy Chilnick and I, we were casting for the Simpsons 20th anniversary special for Fox. And it was my first Comic-Con, and we were there, and I was like, this place is amazing. This place is like a movie. And he and I were talking about that. And then later that night, I'm at a party, a CAA party, CAA, which is my agency, and it's Stan Lee's agency. And I was there, and his agent says to me, Jessica Matthews says, would you like to meet Stan? And I was like, oh, my God, I would love to. It would be an honor. So I went over, and I was like, Mr. Lee, you know, as a kid growing up in West Virginia, you got to know how much you inspired me. You know, your comic books, you know, they you know, made this little awkward kid want to tell his own stories. You know, they gave me confidence. And he was just like, oh, my God, thank you. And he goes, you know what? We should make a movie together. We should make a documentary. You know what? We should make a documentary about Comic-Con. And I was like, that's a great idea, Mr. Lee. Thank you so much. And then literally I turned around, and Peter Michelli, you know, my TV agent at CAA, I said to Peter, he goes, so how was it meeting Stan? I was like, it was amazing. We want to make a movie about Comic-Con. And Peter goes, he goes, that's a great idea. You should meet my other client who's coming into town tomorrow. Cut to tomorrow as I'm having breakfast with Joss Whedon. And I'm sitting with Joss Whedon telling him, saying, oh, yeah, so Stan's on board. We want to make this movie about Comic-Con. And Joss is like, he goes, listen, I'm in. It was amazing. Like, it was the most crazy kind of Hollywood moment that has ever happened in my life.
You know, what comes across so incredibly strongly in your movie is how beautiful and gracious Stan Lee is with his fans.
Yeah, completely. And he's one of those people who, he's such an inspiration. Like, I love, it was, for me, it was just such a thrill to get to work with Stan. And it was an even greater thrill to see just how he is still so passionate about something that now you got to think he's been doing for 60 years, that he's just as excited today as he was when he was 20. You know, here's a guy who every day, just, you know, like I feel like I'm the luckiest guy ever, Stan Lee, like, and I didn't even create Spider-Man, you know? It's like, imagine how much more happy I'd be if I invented, like, Thor and the X-Men. It's like, that's pretty awesome. I think that, you know, for him, here he is, you know, in his mid-80s, and he's kind of seen the fruit of all his labors be so realized on such a grand scale with all of these films and just their acceptance in, like, such a mainstream way that, I mean, I think he is. I think he's so gracious. I think he is so good with people, and he's nonstop. He's like the Energizer Bunny. The guy has more energy than anybody.
You know what? And I think he kind of epitomizes what characterizes a lot of them that attend the Comic-Con and all of them that are featured in your film, and that they kind of hold on to that sense of adolescent wonder.
Yeah. That's exactly right. Like, I love Eli Roth telling the story of, he goes, like, we were the first generation of kids, like, actually kept our Star Wars toys. So we kept our Star Wars figures because we thought that was all there is. And he goes, but no, it just keeps going. There's more things. There's more stuff. There's more things to be passionate about and excited about. And now that's going into a whole new generation. Like, my son, who's 5 years old, like, I showed him Star Wars, like, for the first time when he was, like, three. And, you know, now I grew up loving Star Wars action figures. Now my son, you know, he loves Star Wars 50. Now he loves Star Wars Lego figures. And so we're building all the crazy things out of, like, Legos for Star Wars. And it's amazing. There is this kind of – what I told somebody else what I love about Comic-Con, and that's one of the things that you see in the film where we talk to a lot of families. You see couples that fell in love. You see families that are there at Comic-Con together. Is there is this magical thing that comes through not just comics, not just movies, not through video games and kind of this whole kind of pop culture phenomenon that it represents. There is something familial about it that you can pass down to someone, that you can share with someone. That isn't just a friend, that it can be something that you share with, like, with your son or your daughter.
Absolutely. But it started out very humbly. They're hoping, as it says in your film, for at least
500.
You know, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, they were hoping for 500 people. Cut to, you know, 35 years later, and here they are with, you know, 150,000 people.
Was there a moment, do you think, that a kind of defining moment where it became a phenomenon, where that changed?
You know, that's a really good question. It would have to be probably somewhere around, I bet it for the first time it happened was probably around the first Batman, probably around, like, the Michael Keaton Batman. I can imagine that was big. And then I would think it would be I almost put those film milestones as being ones that bring more attention to Comic-Con, because that's what those films do a great job of. People love to say that it's ruined Comic-Con, but what I think those films do is they bring a tremendous amount of attention to this place that deserves attention.
Right. So yeah. you don't feel, because this is covered a bit in your film, when the businesses and the studios figured out that they had, you know, potential big money source in this event, people started complaining that it was the commercialization of Comic-Con, but you don't feel
sure.
when I was
12 years old, or, you know, I'm trying to remember how old I was when I went to my first comic book convention, there were already people there selling knickknacks that had to deal with films. They were selling lunch boxes from, you know, Shazam and Batman and all this other stuff. There was already a merchandising going on. What people realized in kind of this post, you know, the post-Star Wars world and everything else is that you could really commodify everything around these properties. Mm-hmm. And so what Comic-Con has done is just kind of further expanded on that, and it's the commodification of everything within the popular arts. So it's not just movies and video games. It's everything. And all of those, a lot of them still do stem from comic books. And I buy more comic books now and read more comic books now as an adult than I ever read as a kid. You know, I don't go physically buy paper comics. I download them, you know, from Comixology and put them on my iPad. But I buy and read more now, and I know other friends of mine, you know, are exactly the same way. So I don't think it's hurting the comic book business. It may be hurting kind of that trade version, but the trade version is being hurt in every business.
Right, right.
You know,
absolutely.
Just like people, you know, it's like paper books aren't being bought now. You know, people are buying their e-books. So that side of the business is faltering. The creation of comic books themselves is not.
Mm. Before I let you go,
sure.
I want to ask you. You have a film at Tribeca too. You're busy.
Yes, Mansum. It is a movie about being manly and handsome. Mansum. And it was
That's
fun.
Great.
Like, we made that film with Will Arnett and Jason Bateman. And it's a doc that looks at this, you know, crazy, ridiculous world of male grooming. And, I think people will think it's funny.
Okay, that's Morgan Spurlock. His new film, Comic-Con, Episode 4, A Fan's Hope. Actually, it opens, let me see, I have it right here. It's going on tour, actually, in April. I'll go through
mm-hmm.
those tour dates. But it opens on the 5th in L.A., it's available on video on demand April 6th, and then the 13th it opens up in New York. But throughout the month of April, it's on a road tour to places like Atlanta, Orlando, Miami Beach, Rochester, Albany, Philadelphia, Connecticut,
mm-hmm.
Cincinnati, Chicago, and Detroit all through April. So it's well worth seeing. And Comic-Con is definitely a force to be reckoned with in the entertainment world. I mean, all eyes are on that every year. So, there you go. Let's bring on Dean. Hey, Dean.
Hey, how's it going?
Are you still on the bus?
No, I'm here at the festival. About 8 o'clock, I have the screening of Compliance that you wanted me, so I'm going to comply with going to see Compliance like you requested.
Well, I just heard there was I got an email from Sundance, and somebody said Compliance is the best movie there.
Mm.
So I thought, why not?
Well, good.
especially given your lackluster day yesterday, where you weren't able to see much of anything you cared about.
Yeah, yesterday was pretty bad. The previous day, the opening night was good. I saw a pretty good block of short docs that, you know, sometimes were a little too short, but sometimes, you know, hit the mark. There was a really good doc, short doc from the Netherlands called I'm Never Afraid, which was about a young an 8-year-old motocross champion who was born with his heart on the wrong side of his body.
Mm.
And that was a brilliant little, you know, slice of life from that country. And there was a movie about urban beekeepers in Washington D.C. area called The Capital Buzz, which was fun and inventive. And and the opening night movie was an indie film called Life Happens with Kristen Ritter and Kate Bosworth, mm-hmm. Kristen Johnson, Seymour Cassell is in it for a little bit. He's underused in it. It's a little what I call a romantic momedy. It's about a a woman who has a baby who's trying to get back into the dating world and trying to find herself in her employment life and so forth and so on. It's nice to see a movie that, you know, that's sort of like Bridesmaids in that it, you know, it focuses in on conversations and relationships between women, you know, almost exclusively. And not always, you know, conversations about, you know, what guys they're dating and everything, but just about their lives. We don't get a lot of movies that are like that. So it wasn't a perfect movie. It had a lot of cliches in it, but and a little bit of pandering to a, you know, a perceived audience that, you know, they might perceive wants more of a kind of a sitcom-y kind of feel to their comedies. But it was okay. It was good. I hope to see better stuff from the filmmaker in the future. The filmmaker is Kat Coiro, and the lead actress who also co-wrote the movie, Kristen Ritter, was terrific. I think I'm getting her name right, Kristen Ritter. She was really terrific in it. So, you know, pretty good thing. But yesterday was not so good. I saw a block of, you know, I saw a pretty dull feature doc about families who have loved ones in Iraq and Afghanistan have been left behind for a long time. The film was called Flat Daddy, and it was just basically an extended, you know, segment that you might see on, you know, your local news about a local, you know, a local wife that's been left behind, you know, by someone who's in Iraq or whatever for a long, you know, been there for a long time. And it really didn't offer anything new, anything beyond, you know, rah-rah for the troops, you know, no piercing questions about why the war is, you know, what we're fighting for or whether they think it's worth it or whether they think about extended deployments for people or whatever for their loved ones. It's, you know, just kind of sort of like a kind of a big home movie, really. But then I was very disappointed with a lot of the drama docs or the drama narrative shorts. There was only one or two of those that I really, well, two or three that I really liked. One in particular was called Another Bullet Dodged, which was from L.A., and it was about a guy that's, it follows this guy that's picking up his former girlfriend so she can go get an abortion, you know, which of course he's responsible for the baby. And he's just very, very callous and sort of mean and kind of self-involved. And it was a very, very, like, discomforting documentary, I think, for a lot of people watching it because they probably saw a lot of themselves in it, you know.
So that was a documentary short.
That was a narrative short.
Okay.
And then
but Gerard Depardieu had one that you liked, right?
Yeah, it was called Winter Frog. It was it's you know, from France. It was nice to see you know, somebody who really knows how to act in a film here, you know. it was just a, you know, I mean, you know, I mean, you know, I mean, he's like a legend in the acting world. So I mean, even though I like Kristen Ritter and Life Happens, I mean, she's no Gerard Depardieu. I mean, he's been in a billion movies. So,
well, yeah.
So, Gerard Depardieu.
Can we make bumper stickers that say you're no Gerard Depardieu?
Gerard Depardieu is like Marlon Brando big now. Like, you know, Apocalypse Now, Marlon Brando big, by the way. But it was a good little movie about you know, not perfect, but a good little movie about a widower who owns a winery and vineyard who loses his wife very memorably in the very first very quick scene in the movie, and then is kind of nursed back to health by a Japanese attendee at the winery who kind of inspires him to go on living, you know, after his wife's death. So it was a good little movie. You know, there was another one that was really terrific, like outstandingly terrific, called and let me get the title right here, because it was called Last Words of the Holy Ghost. And it's based on a short story about a kid that's trying to he's trying to have sex with this this girl that's a born again Christian, but she won't sleep with him unless he gets baptized and gets saved. So he goes through that process, but then he discovers that she has sort of a deceitful side to her that's not really Christian. So I really like that movie. It was a 20 minute movie. It was very complete. It had everything you want in a really good movie. Bright visuals, extremely good writing, very good acting, an unusual story that you've never seen before. I liked that. I saw also last night two features. I saw one from Brazil called The Clown, which was a little too derivative of like a Coen Brothers movie, but without the narrative drive that those Coen Brothers movies have, it was a quirky little story about a guy who's a clown in a traveling circus, and I can't really figure out when the movie is set. It seems like it's set in the 60s, but I can't really tell. He decides that he wants a more bland life. He doesn't want to be with the circus anymore. Unfortunately, this conflict is introduced in the movie way too late, and the movie spends a lot of time, just focusing in on a lot of quirky people that are, I don't know, I just didn't really find it very funny, which is too bad because the movie's called The Clown, and you hope, but it has a lot of, a lot of people don't like clowns because they don't think they're funny, and this movie's not going to change their opinion on clowns. I personally find clowns unfunny too, and I find it uncomfortable to sit in a crowd watching a clown because you just feel the static in the air.
What's the best movie ever made about a clown?
Shake the Clown.
Movie? No, I would disagree. Best movie ever been made about a clown.
I think you're being facetious, but
I was being facetious. It's the first thing that came to mind.
And I have, I have Bobcat Goldthwait's movie, God Bless America, tonight. I'm hoping to see that.
Definitely go see that. I mean, that's...
And definitely say, like, Shakes the Clown if he's there. Don't say, I didn't like,
Well, he's not here, but, I'm not a big fan of his, his brand
Quick
of
change.
Nihilism.
Change. That's a good movie.
Quick
about,
Change,
huh?
I'll go with Quick Change, or maybe, Lestrada or The Clowns or something like that from
what about,
Felina,
oh, yeah.
What about Remembering the Freedmans? Capturing the Freedmans or whatever.
That would be a good,
that would definitely be a great clown movie.
That's very good, Jamie. Thank you. Extra credit.
that's a good choice.
Keep score,
Jerry.
Come on, man.
Also, just to let you know, last night, I think you'd want me to report on this, I also saw last night the... Scottish adaptation. I guess it's by Rob Braden, I think. It's based on Irvine Welsh's book Ecstasy, which of course you can probably imagine is about.
Oh, so they made that into a movie.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
And if you've seen Trainspotting, you've pretty much seen Ecstasy because they really follow it right down the line to the point where all of the characters are introduced with freeze frames with their names on it. It's like
right. Okay, but is it any good though? I mean, out of curiosity, is it any good?
I mean, if you want to see Trainspotting again, but you want to see something different,
But did you ever see the Acid
it,
House?
But,
did you ever see
huh?
the other the Acid House?
Yeah, another movie I don't care for.
Right,
I mean,
I'm just saying. I mean, it's for those first couple of Irvine Welsh novels, it's hard to sort of break out of that. I mean, everyone is begging Danny Boyle to make this a sequel into a movie, but I don't see that ever happening.
I mean, why have a movie about ecstasy if it's just going to follow the... I mean, why make these movies if they're just about people doing these drugs? What's the point?
Tell you the point perfectly. Oh,
okay.
The point is living vicariously through others. I mean, that's the point. In all seriousness, Dean, that is the point. About Train Spotting and to a lesser extent the Acid House. But there was an audience for that. Is there an audience today? I don't know.
I didn't go see Train Spotting because I wanted to see how
And I have to give credit to Boyle. I have to give credit to anybody. Because those books, the way that Irvine Welsh writes is, it's beautiful writing, but in the dialect and everything,
that it is not, at the time at least, was very uncommon for American audiences. So I applaud him for doing that. Now, there is another, if I'm not mistaken, there's another Irvine Welsh book that they turned into a movie. I mean, I used to read a lot of Irvine Welsh. I haven't read anything in the last decade. But I'd be curious, Ecstasy is from, what, 96 or 97? I'd be curious to see it. I mean, I had no idea that they were still making these things. So,
But is he like a William S. Burroughs kind of writer, or what?
Kind of. He's a very, very bright individual. Very I mean, there's some stuff that takes place in the projects and everything that's very depressing, but very, very fascinating. I mean, it's just beautiful prose. Beautiful.
Well, I mean, as books, they probably work a lot better and are a little bit more different from each other than the movies are, because this movie in particular, even if you look at the poster for this movie, it looks like it's made by Danny Boyle in the Trainspotting mode.
You know,
I mean, they're not.
Three of us are veterans at this. You know, if it's something that works well once, you're going to duplicate it as many times as possible, and you obviously want to get that audience. Regardless of how old they are, that saw Trainspotting and made it like an indie hit, you're going to try to, you know, go after them or their offspring. So
okay, yeah, but why make the movie the exact same way? I mean, why make a movie that has the exact same tricks that the other movie, the most successful movie, had?
Dean, it's embarrassing that you asked that, but it would be even more embarrassing if I answered that.
Well, I know you want to get asses in the seat, but I mean, why?
No one knows anything. Come on, that goes back to William Goldman. No one knows anything. Of course they're going to do it that way. I mean, you want someone to have to be original about it? Come on. I mean, if you came to me and said, I want to make Ecstasy into a movie, I'd say, why? This is what you're banking on? Please tell me you haven't banked the children's future on.
Yeah, just don't make the movie then.
Yeah,
just
I mean,
don't make the movie and
thing,
move
though.
On to something else.
I mean, no, but that's my thing. I mean, it's such an odd thing to want to make a movie of a book from the 90s that is time has passed by. I'm dumbfounded. If you came to me and said, oh, we're going to make Ecstasy in a movie, I mean, that's like saying you want to make another Michael Ondaatje book, Anil's Ghost, into a movie, for that matter, after The English Patient. Come on.
But you just said you would want to see it.
I want to see it in the sense, Jamie, I'd want to see it because it would be better than going to work. How's that?
Well, there are a lot of things that would be better than going to work. You can sit and jack off for a couple hours.
Dean, you know what's really frightening about that statement? I was going to say the exact same thing. I think I'm going to go blow my brains out now.
I mean, you know, so I mean, you know, why not spend your time doing rather than watching Ecstasy?
Can I give you some? Stop listening to the Four Horsemen. Stop it. If you come up, that's your answer to Jack. Stop it. Do yourself a favor. Read something in that night.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a show that, you know, well, you know, you got
yeah,
to.
We won't get
into that.
No, we're not getting into that. Thank God. But, I mean, all right, so what else did you see?
You know, I mean, I the other things, I don't want to get into the things that I cover on Filmicability, which is at Filmicability. blogspot.com. I cover all of the films that I've looked at, in somewhat detail. But I don't really want to get into the things that I didn't like, you know, on this show. There's plenty of, you know, there's plenty more other things to talk
about.
So
this is what you did, Dean. This is what you did. This is why you're a brave soul. Your second write-up about the festival, covering your second day, which was yesterday, you started it saying, you know, the first opening night was great, but the second day, Atlanta Film Festival is already showing why they're problematic. I mean, and that they depend too much on, you know, local fare that isn't necessarily good, and other kinds of films to fill up a schedule instead of focusing on movies that are worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
And you write that, and then you post it on the Atlanta Film Festival Facebook page.
That's right.
That's
because
good.
Because they got to know it, you know.
You're braver than I am.
This might be the first and last Atlanta Film Festival that I go to, but if they can't take the truth, then fuck them.
Yeah.
You know,
well, no, if they can't take a joke, fuck them is the appropriate.
Obviously, you know, they're not going to make any money off of these short films. The best they can do is go to other film festivals and everything. But I'm just giving my honest opinion. And, you know, film festival programmers, you know, they'll see these kind of things. And if they like it, they like it. And if they don't, they don't. They won't go and read my review and make their decisions based on my review. So, really, you know, my review is just – reviews are meant to be there to speak the truth. I'm not here to massage anybody's egos or anything like that.
Oh, I completely understand.
Yeah, I mean, you don't – that's the last thing you want to do.
I just – you know, it would be akin to me posting on Rod Laurie's personal page, I hated your movie. It sucked.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that was my point. I'm not begrudging you your opinion.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is, you know, if they come and listen to this, which I'll post the link to this show on the Atlanta Film page as well, if they come and listen to this...
Thank God.
They have to hear the truth, you know. And I think that film festivals are here to introduce us to the best of the best. They're not here to give big screen showings to all your friends and everything like that. You don't have, you know, over in Park City, Utah, you don't have the program over in Utah filled with a lot of Utah filmmakers, you know. They're really trying to find the best of the best. They get a lot of submissions, and they can find the best of the best. This year at the Atlanta Film Festival, which is very well run as an event, it had a very nice closing night party with a excellent little you know music video / narrative film short called Old Man Cabbage that was beautiful and accompanied live by the stars of the movie, which was a band named Blair Crimmins and the Hookers, and the filmmaking by Raymond Carr was excellent. It was like a little silent movie homage, and the event was really nice, and the people are really nice. It's good to come out and see people together and having fun and everything. But wouldn't it be great if all the movies were great? Why do I have to sit through bad movies just because you want to run a film festival and want to run this event? You know, I mean, make the event about good movies. You could fill the whole place with a lot of good movies.
I understand. Well, maybe they didn't get 100% good movies submitted to them.
Yeah, I mean, you got to take what you get. I mean, you know, maybe the programmer thought they were good movies, though.
Well, here's another thing about the way this film festival is being run. Everything is being shown only once, so you only get a chance to see everything once. Now they're saving the final day, next Sunday. To repeat some things, but they're not announcing what they repeat until the last minute. So you have no idea what's going to be repeated. So really, you only have one time to see things. But what if you cut the number of movies that you had in half and showed the good things twice? So you gave everybody a chance to see things that might be, you know, programmed against each other. You know, you might have one movie that's great, that's programming another movie against another movie that's great.
We'll give people a chance
to see things twice, you know.
Let me just say, when we're talking about quality and film festivals and you bring up Park City, Utah, I saw a movie last night that I think premiered in the Midnight program at Sundance this year that is truly horrendous.
What was it?
Yeah.
Tell us.
ATM, this horror movie?
Yeah.
Which you can imagine it would be silly because, I mean, it's an independent film, and when you're making a horror film and you're thinking, oh, what can I do within a certain budget, you're thinking, let's get a group of characters in an isolated place where we can just shoot it at that place. And, you know, I understand the mentality behind it, but their idea was, and it also goes in line with, you want to make a movie about everyday horrors, like something people do every day so you can scarify that process. This group of characters stuck in an ATM with this killer outside in the middle of the night. And, I mean, it sounds like a comedy, and I wish it was. It would have worked so much better because the implausibility from beginning to end, this whole thing, I mean, you're used to horror movies and saying, get up, why are you stopping? Why are you doing this? You know, you're used to that. This is every moment of this movie. There's something to infuriate you. If you cared anything about the characters of the situation, you would be infuriated. But it's just kind of like disbelief. I mean,
moronic. So we watched 444.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, a movie like that is, I guess, is really meant for just diehard fans of the horror genre that will watch anything and will accept anything as long as there's a six-pack of beer and a bong in front of them.
Well, that's probably it. But what did you think of 444?
Dude, oh, I mean, a double feature of that and Antichrist, I mean, and then if you really wanted to throw a body of evidence in there for a triple feature, dude, does William Dafoe just have this thing about these, I mean, they bill it as an erotic thriller on demand, and I guess, like, parts of it are. It's interesting, but it never goes, I feel like Abel, who I do like, and I actually read the little interview they had in New York Magazine after watching it, is it just me, or does he seem more restrained in his old age?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
well,
like,
that was my point in that question I asked of him. I said, do you think this would be the tone would be different if you made it as a younger man? Because, I mean, I noticed that big time, too.
Yeah, I mean, because he's just really, I mean, it seems like he's more interested, I mean, he's obviously interested, more interested in Dafoe than anyone else, letting him at least go outside. I was happy that Dafoe at least goes outside. Because I was really worried beginning, oh, my God, this is going to just take place inside the apartment the whole time.
Yeah, it does get quite claustrophobic.
So I was happy he went outside. But it is a very different movie from him. Now, I say that because the last thing I saw from him was The Blackout. I saw The Blackout and New Rose Hotel. I hadn't seen the one with the girl from The Sopranos, and obviously Mary and Go-Go Tales are not available in this country, at least.
And it's a movie about the Chelsea Hotel I'd like to see.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating.
You ever see the movie he made about the Virgin Mary?
That's good. Mary, yeah.
Yeah,
really
I haven't
good.
Seen that. Where is that? He said he had suggested that people download that illegally.
Yeah.
At one time.
That's an excellent movie. That's one of his best, I think.
We got a caller. Let me take this call. All right?
All right, yeah.
Okay.
Marcus Marshall, you're on the air.
Hi, how's it going?
How are you?
Doing
hey,
good.
How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. I mean, the idea of Morgan Spurlock doing a brand new movie on the whole Comic-Con and really exploring the nerd thing is great. One of the things that I didn't know if you pre-recorded the interview because I've only just gotten into, listened to a show recently within the last 10 minutes, and I heard you were talking to Morgan Spurlock.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that I did want to ask him, which I think is still relevant to us now, is that how well do you think that Morgan Spurlock would do, considering his experiences through his documentary career in a spoken word show very similar to someone like Henry Rollins?
I think he'd be smashing. Because he's the star of his films, essentially.
And Comic-Con is the only movie that he's not in he's made, actually.
Really?
He's not featured in it. I don't know that he's as much of a poetic showman as Henry Rollins is. So I don't know that he
can
fill that spot.
But he could do something. Could do it, I think. Not as
I think he does it kind of in some of his cable projects, doesn't he?
Yeah.
I believe that when it comes to Morgan Spurlock, I believe he has a natural flair for just being in front of people and pulling the unexpected out of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes Morgan Spurlock so special, because he just doesn't care. He reminds me of, in the UK here, we used to have, like in the 90s, a show called Brass Eye. And what the actual host did was, it was like a fake news show for half an hour. And they did another one called The Day Today. But what they did, they got celebrities involved, and the celebrities didn't know that it was a prank show. And he seems like the kind of guy who knows how to truly work people. I would truly recommend to the people listening to this to go on YouTube and type in Brass Eye. And if they're not going to type that in, type in the name Chris Morris.
Mm-hmm.
Because the man is a genius, and Morgan Spurlock reminds me of a more honest version of Chris Morris. And the thing was, what Chris Morris did, he did it in the name of humor, while Morgan Spurlock does it in the name of documentary.
Right.
I would say definitely look into that. And
well, I think he's certainly a very articulate guy with definite points of view on things, and he's very comfortable being front and center on camera. I mean, he's kind of the ringleader in his films for the most part, but that's interesting. And he does a lot of TV, so he's amazing. He's got a new series, he's got Comic-Con, and then he's got his other documentary premiering at Tribeca next month.
That's the thing. With Morgan Spurlock, I would like to see him meet someone like a Chris Morris in America, because if you go on YouTube and you type in Brass Eye, it will show you clips. If you want the full series, would you like me to put in my email address into the comments so you can get it? And I'll send you copies of the full series, because as a series itself, a series designed to look exactly like a news show, so people were confused to whether it was a comedy or a news show. I see Morgan Spurlock being someone who would be able to spearhead that in America.
Mm-hmm.
The Onion News Network, you can clearly tell it's a parody.
Yeah.
But imagine watching a half-an-hour news show where you don't know if it's a parody or actual news.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
And actually,
the actual news, it's hard to tell if it's...
Exactly.
So,
come to something where Chris Morris, one of the things he did, he actually invented a brand new drug called cake. And he got all of these celebrities involved through this celebrity campaign. And they didn't even know that they were being spoofed. So he got all of these celebrities in to talk about this horrible new drug called cake. He invented like slang names for it and everything. And just watching the campaign was hysterical.
Mm.
It was just ingenious. And the way he got around it was simple. The news seems to have carte blanche when it comes to not telling people what's going on. And all they have to do is turn around and say, they will be featured on a late night show. You leave it very anonymous.
Right.
All you feature is a late night show where this message will be broadcast. At that point, they won't know whether it's a serious new message comedy. You can bring in major celebrities to support this thing and use it as a comedy thing where you actually trick these where you actually trick people into supporting a campaign that doesn't actually exist.
Mm-hmm.
But you can
that's ingenious, yeah.
Whatever you want. And that's what Chris Morris did. He was a genius. So if one of you could message me on the address that I put below, then I will happily send you the download links to get this.
We'll do that, my friend. I appreciate it very much.
Yeah.
And I think that Morgan Spurlock could make... not the thing about Morgan Spurlock is, for how honest he's been, I think it's time that... for how funny he is and how honest he is, I think he deserves to make a little money and just make it in an honest way where he can point at society and go, you suck.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I'm going to show you how much you suck and take this thing over to America. And I would say if Morgan Spurlock collaborated with Chris Morris, then you would see an amazing half-an-hour show, whether you wouldn't be able to tell whether it was news or comedy.
Well, send us the link, and we'll definitely check it out, and we'll follow up on it on the show.
Definitely. Email me. I'll send you the links.
Thank you so much, Marcus.
Thank you.
It's been a true pleasure to speak to you guys. And
you too. Thank you for listening
in.
Oh, no, it's an honest pleasure. What can I say? It's someone who's interested in an interesting subject, a documentary fan. I'd love to speak to you on Skype down the line.
Let's do that. Thank you, buddy.
All right. Well, you've got my email address.
I do. Thank you, man. Bye-bye.
Have a great night.
You too.
Thank you.
Dean, I'm bringing you back on. Your phone was all interferenced out. Sorry.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Okay. It's good. I wanted to bring up something that I invested a lot of time in this weekend. I actually sat down and from beginning to end I watched season one of The Killing. And it was phenomenal. I don't know This is the AMC series, and it picks up again April 1st. This show had a backlash like I've never seen. It kind of like Twin Peaks, and the Twin Peaks thing is relevant because it follows a single murder case through two seasons now. But the backlash started because there's a couple of red herrings in the first season, and they didn't solve the crime at the end of the first season. But which I think is a bunch of bunk, because detectives follow up leads in big murder cases that don't go anywhere. I mean, that's completely probable. And I don't think that they promised that the killer would be revealed at the end of season one. But my point about the series is it is really great writing and some of the best acting you'll see on TV. It's like the quality of acting on TV is just stratospheric now. So I would recommend The Killing. I was blown away by it. Okay.
I still haven't watched any of it, so I'll take your advice.
It's available now on Blu-ray and DVD. I think it's available starting now. But all right, I want to go through our list for the night, and then we'll close up with our final
all right,
interview.
Another list. Okay.
Let me get to the – it's a list of 50, so I'll get to the top 20. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Just as a reminder, Wednesday night – screenwriting legend Robert Town will be with us. And we're starting to do interviews for the Summer of 87 series. And so far we've got interviews for RoboCop and Summer School and The Untouchables. So that's good. Okay.
Right.
And also the next show I want to talk to you about other topics that we can cover. Because I want to make it a month of kind of 80s nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking of other topics that we can cover about the 80s in connection with that. Whether it be the big producing partners like Simpson Bruckheimer and Golden Globus and all of that kind of stuff. Or I think we can have some fun with it. Okay. This is a list of the 50 greatest character actors, according to Total Film again.
No, not Total Film.
So,
all right.
Well, they're pretty good. And so
all right. These aren't the guys that did the tracking shot thing, are they?
No. These are the guys that did the greatest performances last show.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay, number 20, they say Allison Janney. Number 19, they say David Strathairn.
Okay.
He's very good.
I have no problem with these.
I have none either.
The ordering of these is probably suspect, but these are great character actors that are working now.
Number 18, our buddy Joey Pants, Joe Pantoliano.
Oh, yeah, he deserves to be on here.
Number 17.
Can I mention something about Joe Pantoliano?
Sure.
You know, it really doesn't seem like he's working that much these days.
No,
you know, post Sopranos, you know, I haven't seen him very much at all. So I wouldn't put him in the top 50. He's great, but I just don't think that he works enough.
Number 17, character actor, Holly Hunter.
No, she's not a character actor.
No, she's not. She's really not a character. I mean, no.
You know, one of the definitions of a character actor is kind of like the size of the roles, kind of, and she's more of a lead actress. She's very rarely a supporting actress. So a character actor to me is someone who comes in and supports lead actors, you know, and comes in and can do movies where they only have one scene or whatever, you know. But Holly Hunter rarely has a movie where she only comes in and she rarely has a movie where she's supporting other lead actors, really.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I agree with that assessment, but in her supporting roles, she's been very good. And in supporting roles like, I don't know, like The Firm, she was very good in The Firm. There's
and 13 and so forth.
Yeah.
But,
Number 16, Stanley Tucci.
Mm-hmm.
I find him a little boring, to tell you the truth.
I like
Stanley
Tucci.
Oh, he's great. Oh, he's wonderful.
Joan Allen at number 15.
Really? We're calling her a character actress at this point?
Are there any character actors in this list that are from anything but before the 1990s?
Well, we're 15 out from number one.
All right.
Perhaps.
I consider her a lead actress, to be very honest with you.
She's usually the lead female, but that's usually a supporting written as a supporting
role.
She's done a lot of supporting roles, though. I mean, anything from like Ice Storm to Nixon to, you know, things like that. You know, she's done a lot of supporting roles.
Number 14, our man. He was crazy about us. M. Emmett Walsh.
Yep, I figured he'd have to be on here.
He's definitely one of the greats. Yeah. Definitely, absolutely.
Number 13, Dennis Farina.
Yeah, definitely.
Not for me. I mean, yeah. Another actor that doesn't work enough, and really doesn't. I mean, I like him and everything, but he doesn't do a wide range of roles. He's usually either a cop or a criminal.
Right.
You got to stick with
and
that work.
And he would be the first person to tell you. I mean, he's very shy about talking about himself as an actor,
mm-hmm.
actually.
Mm-hmm.
But he is. I mean, he has a moment in Luck from the last episode of Luck, which has been an incredibly dull show up until these last couple of episodes, where he just stands there in silence with this guy in a room, and the guy doesn't know if he's about to get the hell beat out of him or not. And it's just this completely menacing quality that Dennis Farina has in that scene. And he's literally not doing anything. And he's just holding the screen. I mean, I was amazed by him in that scene. But number 12 is Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Yeah.
I mean, again, you know, I guess she's kind of a character actress in the sense that, you know, even her leads are very quirky always. So they have that quirky feeling that I guess we attribute to a lot of character actors. But, again, she's a lead actress. I don't know. What's their definition of a character actor? It's not the traditional definition, I would think.
Number 11 is Stellan Skarsgård.
No,
he's a lead though. I think I've seen him in he does a lot of lead work too. Maybe not in mainstream American films, but
well, I think a lot of character actors will be doing some lead work. But
yeah,
Hunt for Red October, Breaking the Waves, Ronin, Deep Blue Sea, Dogville, Pirates of the Caribbean, Mamma Mia, Angels and Demons, Thor, The Girl with the Dragon
Tattoo. I mean, he definitely deserves to be on a list.
Those are all supporting roles.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is though, let's face it. I mean, I don't want to sound like I'm, like, harping on, like, or too negative or whatever, but Stellan Skarsgård doesn't have that much of a range. I mean, like, to me, he's kind of the same in almost every movie. His greatest performance is still Breaking the Waves, and that's a lead performance. I wouldn't have him on the list. Not when there's an entire history of acting that you can pick from. It's another short-sighted list.
Number 10, Frances McDormand.
She's definitely great. I mean, she's good in most of everything she's in. So, she's good.
Number,
she definitely counts as a character actress.
Number 9, Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, yeah.
Number 8, John Hawkes.
Oh, yeah, I mean,
I think it's a little early for John Hawkes to be on the top 10, isn't it? I mean, you know, I know he's been doing movies for a long time.
Top 10, yeah.
But he's been doing movies for a long time, but he's really only come into a larger public consciousness since he was nominated for the Oscar 2 years ago. So, you know.
And I think he'll probably be nominated again for this movie, The Surrogate, that's coming out of Sundance,
mm-hmm.
that he's the lead in with he and Helen Hunt, and they say that he's just remarkable in it.
I believe it.
Number 7.
He was excellent in Martha Marcy May Marlene, another character role. So.
Ugh. Number 7, this guy belongs here, Brian Cox.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
He's somebody that's definitely put his time in as a character actor.
Mm-hmm.
Number 6, they have John Turturro.
Okay.
I have no beef with that, none.
Number 5.
Oh, well, that goes without saying.
Chris Walken.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you talk about range. Do you think Chris Walken has range?
Oh, sure.
Oh, definitely.
I mean, you look at him, and I mean, he won his Oscar for The Deer Hunter, but, you know, and but think of Catch Me If You Can and, you know, of course, all the great other quirky roles, more quirky roles that he's played. And, you know, yeah, sure.
Okay.
That range.
Okay. Number four. Please wait while I advance the page. Wow, this is interesting. This is interesting. Brad Dourif, number four.
Yeah.
Yeah.
By all means, definitely.
I mean, you know, for me, I mean, you know, there's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and you know, of course, Wise Blood and everything like that. But yeah, I mean, I guess I'd put him in the top 50 or whatever. Again, this list is weird because you could really people this list with. You have 1,000 British character actors to choose from, you know, 1,000, you know, old-time Hollywood characters. I mean, like, where's you know, Eugene Pallett or people like that, you know.
I don't know who you're talking about.
Or Mel Blanc or people who were, like, from the 30s that were in all the Capra movies and stuff like
right.
that. I mean,
there's a lot of people. There's a lot of people you could do here. I mean,
where's Walter Brennan?
Yeah, I mean, Walter all Brennan. Right.
Where's
a lot
Charles
of people.
Durning?
Brian Dennehy, for that matter.
I don't know. I haven't seen 21 through 50, and we're three out from number one. But here's number three, Dean. And I think you'll be pleased with this. Number three is Christopher Lee. All right. Does you approve of that choice?
I like Christopher Lee, yeah.
Yeah, he has to be on there.
Yeah.
All right. And they actually mentioned the 150 paintings of him here in this article.
That would be great if they did.
Number two, Harry Dean Stanton.
Yes.
Mm-hmm, without a doubt.
And that's an actor that's been working since the 50s. His first movie is Porkchop Hill. People don't realize that he's been in movies for so long, but yeah, he's definitely one of the greats.
That old war horse. Okay, their number one is Steve Buscemi.
I'd say he's definitely one of the greatest character actors working today, for sure. No question about it. That's a recent choice that I have no problem with.
Yeah, I would have no beef with that.
Happening.
And then, you know, I know right outside the top 10 they have Malkovich and Pete Postlethwaite, Chris Cooper, Frank Langella, Sam Elliott.
Why don't these lists just say, we're just going to pick character actors that were working
out of the phone book.
Past 1980?
I don't know.
Why can't they just say that instead of saying these are the best of all time? Because if you're really going to do a best of all time list, you really need to do your research. You know, there's tons of character actors out there that are loved and by a lot of people. They weren't all born in 1962.
They don't list. I mean, I'm looking. They don't list any character actors that aren't working today or that aren't still alive today, in their 50. Other than Pete Postlethwaite. I mean, obviously he's deceased, but
yeah.
He was great. He was great in The Town.
He was.
So there's the list for tonight.
Okay.
We got in a Christopher Lee reference. Everything's all good.
What more could you ask for?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. All right, gentlemen. I think it's time to depart.
Okay.
Okay, I got to get into a movie soon.
Enjoy Compliance.
Yeah, have fun.
Okay. I'll give you a full report on Wednesday night, so I'll just take off now, okay?
All right, buddy. See you later.
All right, see you later.
All right.
Bye-bye. Okay, we're going to end tonight with the second part of our interview with Mark W. Travis. His book is called The Film Director's Bag of Tricks. It's available at markwtravis.com, or you can click on the link here on our description on our homepage for this particular show. Jerry, thank you so much, buddy.
No problem. All right, man. Have
see
a good
you.
One and enjoy.
See you Wednesday night with Robert Towne.
Okay, cool.
All right, bud.
All right, bye.
Good night. So tell me about actors. I mean, you start out discussing rehearsal, and that's a luxury that a lot of films don't have. But tell me the main benefits of a rehearsal for you.
Well, again, coming from theater, Jamie, it's inconceivable for me to think about making a film and not rehearsing. I know there are a lot of directors who don't want to rehearse or don't rehearse, and there are a lot of producers who don't think it's worth spending the money. I mean, the rehearsal is so crucial. If I'm going to take a cast of character actors and turn them into these individuals, these fictional characters that we want to believe are credible characters, and all I'm going to do is take them on the set and we're going to shoot, the chances of me getting anywhere close to authentic characters is very, very, very slim. Now, this is quite honestly done a lot, and it's done, quote, very successfully a lot. By successfully, I mean these films make a lot of money. But if you look at films that or characters' performances where it's strong, compelling characters, it usually comes out of a deep, deep rehearsal process where you get that chance, like you do in theater when you're rehearsing, which is really important, to try stuff that doesn't work. Just spend an hour on that scene and try it two or three different ways or with that character or with that relationship. And maybe it could work this way, or maybe the relationship can go that way. And without that opportunity to experiment, how are you going to find what the strongest, most compelling way to approach the character or the relationships or the scenes are? I mean, you take a director like Sam Mendes, whose first film was American Beauty. But he's a theater director, and he actually cast a lot of theater actors who are used to rehearsing. Some film actors don't even know how to rehearse or don't want to rehearse or don't like to rehearse. But if you get – I obviously cast a lot of theater actors, actors with theater experience, because they like to rehearse and they like to go in and explore that and to explore the depths of those characters, to me is crucial. I mean, why tie one hand behind my back, you know, before I go in and shoot something? And also, on the economic side, and I've proved this a few times, my argument with producers is, I will save you time and money. You give me the rehearsal, I'll save you time and money. Now, time and money, as you know, is spent in production. And I've been able to cut days off of production just because a project is so well rehearsed that suddenly I'm saving them time and I'm saving them money. And the other thing I promised them, I said, and the quality of the film will be higher. And it's hard for a producer to argue against that, but to me, it's absolutely crucial.
Well, I'm definitely on your side on that, and I'm you know, I think of Francis Coppola and what he does with actors, and he puts them all in his kitchen, and they have a big feast, and it also gives them a chance to begin to feel comfortable with one another, like they're a family for that period of time. You know, it establishes that. But just to play devil's advocate, how do you respond to the film actor that might say they don't like rehearsal because it erases any chance of spontaneity in the moment on the set?
Well, I would tell him he's wrong, but that won't get me very far. We're in a tricky area. This is a great area, Jamie, and it's very, very tricky. The actor who says, I'm good on the first or second take, you're going to ruin my spontaneity, I'm going to lose my performance in the rehearsal process, that actor, here's a good example. The subtext of that line to me, Jamie, is, I'm afraid because I don't know how to rehearse. I'm afraid because I have no... My technique as an actor, my skills as an actor are so limited that, you know, I just have to go out and sort of burst and give it and hope, you know, and pray that it's going to work in one or two takes. And so my job in that case is to actually, in the rehearsal process, and I can do it in a matter of minutes, literally minutes, with the way I work with actors, which is another whole discussion on the Travis technique. But within minutes, I can show him. This actor, I said, let me show you how I will rehearse with you. And usually 10 minutes later, they go, oh, my, okay, great, let's do it. Because my way of rehearsing is which we can't get into in this interview, but it's a way of helping the actor bypass the actor himself and get so quickly, deeply into the character that he experiences being in the character. And all that spontaneity and improvisational skills and everything that he's depending on is right there with him, and he will never go off track.
Right. Well, I wanted to touch on this point because you hear interviews with great actors, and they speak about what makes a great director. And inevitably they say, you know, he's this person is manipulating me to behave a certain way, but I don't feel that manipulation, and actually I feel like it's my idea when in fact it's the director's idea, which is another delicate kind of situation.
So which I think I touch on in the bag of tricks that it's sort of a general, especially in theater, and having studied theater for a long time and done a lot of theater, most theater directors will agree that their job is to, in the rehearsal process, lead the actors to discovering what the director already knows. And the reason for that, where that director could have just told them, say this is what it is, or this is what's going on, or this is what's going on with your character. The reason for that is if the actor discovers it on his own, then he owns it, and it becomes part of it, the organic nature of the character. If the director tells him the same piece of information, then it becomes a cognitive piece of information that was imposed upon the actor, and the actor will either consciously or unconsciously may even resent it a little bit, like, oh, fine, you want me to do it that way. And it becomes a mental battle between the actor and the director, whereas if the actor discovers it, and it's really important, and this is a little bit of the bag of tricks notion, that when the actor discovers it, when I'm doing this and the actor discovers something that I want him to find out or learn about the character, and he goes, oh, my God, I just realized that my character is ABC, and I usually go, oh, wow, that's great. That's amazing. Now, I maybe knew this a month ago. Or had this thought a month ago. But just acknowledging the actor, like, wow, you just discovered something amazing. Now the actor feels like, I've discovered something, I like it, it's mine, the director's happy, and that's pretty much what that sort of the quote you just gave me from, generic quote from a lot of actors, that's what they're talking about. A director who can let them free to explore and discover, and even at the same time you go, this director knows exactly where he's leading me. But he's leading me in such a way that I'm discovering all these wonderful things. So why should I complain?
Mm. Well, there are all kinds of different directors out there that use their powers of persuasion in various ways. But what do you think of the directors that say if it's a particularly combative film or combative scene? I think of Oliver Stone and a lot of his early productions, and they ride their actors. I mean, they're completely hardcore directors that ride their actors to that emotion in a very adversarial way. Do you think that's ultimately beneficial, or do you advise against something like that?
Well, it becomes very personal. I mean, first of all, I advise against it, and the very personal part of it is I've seen some of this and heard a lot of this. These are some of these approaches, not necessarily Oliver Stone, but some other directors, and it actually borders on or goes across the line into abusive. And I think there's no need to be abusive in this business. If I'm running a boot camp, and I'm going to send people into war, okay, I can understand that because you're kind of trying to harden them up enough so they can say, you know, they don't get killed or something. But this is not a boot camp, and this is to push and force and cajole and literally trick people into or trip them into some kind of emotion that you can capture on camera once and go, oh, great, I got it. That's really abusive. I heard of one director, a very well-known director, who couldn't get an actress to scream the way he wanted her to in a scene. And he kept shooting, and he couldn't get the scream at all. And I think it was days later, she was sitting on the set, or standing on the set, and he had the microphone unknown to her, placed over her, and he ran, came up behind her and grabbed her, you know, and in a very inappropriate way, and she screamed. And his reaction was, great, now I got it.
Ugh.
You know, and now that's abusive.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But there are directors who will do that. They will, you know, they will be, you know, abusive to the actors, and I think that's totally unnecessary because it's, you know, it's, first of all, it's not authentic to the character. That, you know, you're just pushing the actor into an emotional state that you want them to be in, and
mm-hmm.
in many ways it has nothing to do with the character. So it's unfortunate that it happens. The other unfortunate thing is directors who don't know how to rehearse at all and just will cast an actor and then get angry at them for not giving them the emotion they want. Why can't, you know, and then all of a sudden it becomes all the actor's fault. Why can't you give me the anger or the tear or the rage or the love or whatever that, you know, and thinking there's a lot of directors who treat actors like they're robots. Why can't you just turn on that emotion?
Hmm.
You know, or do it like, you know, in that other film, you did that. Why can't you do that here? You know, and there are a lot of directors who just really have, and it's sad, who just have no skills of relating to other people or especially actors in this sort of very delicate creative environment in a way to help the actors genuinely create these characters and genuinely tap into these emotions.
Well, and I agree, and that approach only kind of breeds insecurity. And you hear actors all the time, and you discuss this in your book, that what they want is to feel safe. They want kind of a safe environment in which to create and explore.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right,
so that,
exactly.
that's a major job of the director as well in working with his people to create
yeah.
that environment.
Yeah, and I think it's important for directors to understand the definition of a safe environment. I mean, a safe environment means obviously no abuse. A safe environment also means nobody on the set talks to the actors about their work or their character, not even the other actors. In other words, to allow the actor to work really independently and to hear critique, criticism, or direction only from the director. And then
mm-hmm.
on top of that, the director having a way of working with actors that will encourage them to keep exploring and pushing the envelope and going maybe into areas that they had not thought of or felt uncertain about.
Well, and you close your book with a great series of conversations with some terrific directors, including Mark Rydell, who I know you've worked with for many years, and
right.
John Badham, who we've had on the show, I think, three or four times.
Great.
We love John Badham. And he himself wrote a terrific book on directing actors that I also am very fond of. What were the things that you learned in conversation with those filmmakers?
Oh, well, there were with the ones that are in the book?
In the book, yeah.
Yeah, well, there were so many of them. I picked these directors for the book sort of arbitrarily, I thought. Then I looked at it later and I said, no, maybe I didn't. There's a part of me that picked them because, you know, they are thinking and working in a very similar way that I do, in terms of just working with actors and working with writers. But to answer your questions, the things that I discovered to me was sometimes when they would present solutions to problems that we all run into, whether it's a problem with an actor or a problem with a writer or a script, and they would present a solution that I hadn't heard yet. I went, oh, or it's a solution that I had heard of, but I hadn't heard it, but used quite in that way. That to me was a delight. One of my favorite things to do, apparently, obviously, is just to sit down and talk with directors and writers and actors about the work we're doing. So in those interviews, I mean, it was great, and it was great later even reading them again to hear how they're approaching these concerns. And on the flip side, Jamie, sometimes it's very comforting to hearing that other directors who are very, you know, these are highly skilled and experienced directors, are having exactly the same problems I'm having. And I'd go, well, that makes me feel better. I don't think it's, because, you know, as much as directing is a hugely collaborative process with a lot of people, the one person you're not collaborating with when you make a film is another director. So you're, in many ways, you're very alone. You're out alone out there with a crew of 200 people, but it's you all by yourself. So it's nice to share these ideas, and a lot of these people who I've interviewed and a lot of other directors, I mean, I spend a lot of time with them all the time just sharing these ideas and talking, and that, to me, has been some of the best education I've ever gotten.
In your experience and as a director personally and speaking to these directors, what do you think are the defining characteristics of a great director? I mean, I'm thinking obviously a strong sense of story, but I mean that falls into being empathetic, which I think is important for any artist. They have to be problem solvers, and life experience would be important as well.
Yeah, I think so. Yes. One thing, you know, your question is what makes a good director or something like that. First of all, on one side, there's just knowing all the skills. As you say, you know, understanding story, how does story work, how do screenplays work, you know, and then understanding the tools and techniques of translating screenplay to the screen, which eventually gets into cameras and all of that, all the technology as much as you can. But with all these skills that you can learn as a film director, the other 50% of directing, that's really 50% or more, is your ability to work with other people. In other words, your ability to talk to someone, to listen to them, to understand what they're doing. And I don't mean just the actors. I mean anybody, somebody on the crew, your cinematographer or your sound person or the writer, obviously, and the actors. Your ability to communicate with them, to connect with them, to listen to them, to understand what their problems was, and then your ability to help them and support them so that they can do the best job that they can do on your film. And this is something that's obviously not taught a lot in film school because it's more psychology. I mean, it's a lot of what my book is about, the psychology of working with writers and actors. But this is a hard one to learn. And I've worked with so many directors all over the world. And sometimes I watch a young director or even a professional director working, and I go, oh, we got a problem. In my head, I'm thinking, we have a problem here. The problem is this person doesn't like these actors. I can sense that he doesn't. He resents. There's something going on. Again, it's all subtextual. And I said, this is a bigger problem than his ability to understand story or even talk to actors and all that. So it's a very, very complex task here.
Mm. You know, we've talked about the craft of directing and along with that, a little bit about the craft of acting and writing as well. So I always like to ask this question. What are the performances and the films that have meant the most to you in your life?
Oh, wow. Well, I was talking with a friend of mine the other day about when I was in college and I got a job. It was very interesting. At another college, I was a guest artist, and one of my jobs at that other college was running the projector for their film series. And I was there for like 3 months. And 3 months, the whole film series that we showed were all the films of Ingmar Bergman.
Mm.
And that was really interesting. So I was introduced to a lot of films that I had never seen. And so I have a great fondness for Bergman's work, but I have a very different experience with his work because these were 16-millimeter prints that were shown, you know, with a very noisy projector. So I'm watching these films with the sound of a rattling projector in my ear, but it's all subtitled, so I'm fine. Yeah. I don't know what, you know, when you ask about performance. So those films, I'm just watching, and this is his whole black and white series. I mean, eventually it was Fanny and Alexander and all that, and the more later work. But just watching what this man as a director could do visually and the themes he was dealing with and the concepts he was dealing with in a very subtle, profound, but a very bold way. And I remember watching that. Now, at that time, I wasn't in film at all. I was just studying theater. And I remember watching that going, oh, my God. I mean, thinking at that time, this is so far away from me. There's no way I could even get anywhere close to what the, not even close to Bergman's work, but even, you know, making a film. I don't think that this will ever happen. So I wasn't even thinking of that. I was just sitting there sort of stunned by the work and the artistry. Then you also asked about certain actors. I mean, there are a lot of actors I admire enormously. I mean, one of my favorites is Colin Firth, who I've been watching for years. I mean, if you just look at The King's Speech and then look at Shakespeare in Love, and you look at the range that this actor can accomplish, which is, I think, is absolutely extraordinary. Or you look at Damien Bashir in Better Life, who was nominated for Best Actor this time. If you look at his work in A Better Life, and then you go back and watch him in Weeds, the TV series, and you'd be hard-pressed to even recognize that it's the same human being.
So or see him play Castro. Did you see him play Castro in the...
No, I didn't. I didn't.
It's extraordinary.
Yeah. And it's... You know, because lots of times people ask me, what's your favorite performance? I said, it's not a performance. I said, look, to me, with actors, it's look at the range that this character, this actor can cover, you know, and the complexity. I mean, Meryl Streep is an obvious one, but this complexity of characters that they can cover, where there are a lot of very famous, that we all know, A-list actors who, you know, are working all the time, and you look at their work, and they're in a very narrow range. They don't wander that much off from who they are or what they've done before. And it's fine. I mean, they're giving fine performances, but they're not capturing my admiration as much as Damien Bashir or someone like that, who is just stunningly, you know, dazzling. And the complexity and the range of what they can do.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, a lot of our movie stars, and some of them are, you know, movie stars, kind of but also fantastic actors. But just the movie star quandary in general kind of limits you to playing a certain type of role. But then you see a Meryl Streep or what have you, and just the breadth of their expression just seems so limitless. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, and there is that trap too. You take movie stars. I'll mention a few. You take like a Tom Cruise or a Brad Pitt or a George Clooney. Those three, or Julia Roberts or someone like that. And basically, when they're in a film, we as the audience have an expectation of what they're going to do. It's going to be in a very narrow range. We expect George Clooney to be pretty much like George Clooney, and that's the power of his career, really. And we don't want to expect him to very, very far off from that. And the sad thing is, you know, actors become trapped in that because, you know, that's what they get hired to do. And that's what will sell the film again, you know, sell the next film. But then on the other hand, you know, at least you and I and millions of other people say, you know, Meryl Streep's in a movie. Whoa, I wonder what she's going to do. But if you look at her in The Iron Lady and compare that to Mamma Mia, there's an extreme for you. And what I love about her work, totally committed to anything, whatever she does. It's a total commitment. I mean, Mamma Mia is a piece of fluff that means nothing. Also, Colin Firth's in that. But, you know, it's just a piece of fluff. It has no... I mean, it's just sheer entertainment. And then she does something like Iron Lady. You go, she can do anything. It's kind of frightening.